I'll start with a small quote from Lyndon LaRouche. Man is intrinsically good. All babies are born good. All people's babies are born good. Each one is like an angel. Every baby is an angel. A baby comes. It's an angel on a mission. Now, it does not come with any instructions. It comes with a capability. The baby will discover what its mission is. The baby will grow and develop and the capabilities to carry out the mission. Then the baby will die as an older person. But the baby will, like an angel, have come to society and done some good. And society needed that angel to come to society at that time to do that good. And anybody who's any good wishes to be such an angel. You come with no special powers, no ticket telling you what your instructions are. But you have to recognize your instructions from your situation and do some good, so that when you die, you have been an angel who came and did some good for humanity. Humanity needed you. You are a part of humanity forever. Now, that was the beginning of a speech he gave to a bunch of Eastern European and Russian economists in 1994. Babies are good. Yeah. Or, sorry, 1997. Now, this is about Venice, but you shouldn't be surprised that I start like that, because this is the issue of Venice and what Venice meant. Now, the interesting thing also is that the best authorities on Venice were poets. And we'll look at one of these poets tonight, partway through the lecture, the class. Now, how many of you know a bit about Venice? Or know some of its history? Very interesting. The reason for that will become more clear as you understand Venice and its role in history. Now, Venice was an oligarchy. That's very important to understand. And a bit of general history before we get to two specific examples from Venice's history that express its character most appropriately. Now, how did Venice function as an oligarchy? Now, they called themselves a republic, but they weren't really. Not in the sense that we think of a republic. What you had was a top-down control of the society, much like we have today, in terms of the concentration of financial power. Now, the government was set up where you had something called the Arengo, which was a popular assembly where they could assemble sometimes up to 10,000 people. And this initially was used for appointing the Doge, or the Duke, who is the head of the Venetian state. But over time, this became, it really didn't have any power any longer. It was simply a symbolic gesture when a new doge was elected by the Senate and the upper bodies, the more concentrated bodies. They would present the doge to the population. The population would cheer and clap like good little slaves, and then, you know, and that would be, they would be giving their assent to what the oligarchy was doing. Now, the main body within this, what we were looking at also was a closed system. By the 13th to the 14th century, what was called the Grand Council basically closed its doors, where they passed a piece of legislation that said if your family is not already a member of this group, like if you don't already have somebody sitting on the Grand Council, you no longer have the opportunity. Like any new families, any kind of new made men or whatnot, hoping to become a part of this, were shut out. And that held for the next 500 to 600 years. Now the way it worked was you had this grand council, which was made up of every nobleman. As soon as a man turned 25, if he was part of one of the oligarchic families, he entered and gained a seat in the council. And later on, in around the 16th century, there would be as many as 2,500 members of this. But this was very unwieldy, and it didn't really have much power. The real power was in the Senate. Now, the senators, there would be about 120. And the senators were elected by the Grand Council. But now, something which I just discovered this morning was that it seems, okay, this is great. Here's a checks and balances, right? You know, you're going to have people cycling through, and the Senate will be changing and things like this. And there's elections every year. And, of course, if you have 2,500 people, should be a lot of people that are able to be senators and things like that. But in reality, the same people were getting voted in over and over again. That became the norm. So the elections were simply, it was a nominal election, but nothing really would change. If people died, there would be new members appointed. But once you got in, you were pretty well there for life, as long as you didn't do anything really stupid.
Mm-hmm. Because you said there was a law passed that didn't allow anyone who wasn't currently a member to become a member.
Yeah. Well, to become a part of the Grand Council. And then there is a further... There's a further issue that once you became a senator, you basically became a senator for life. So here you've gone from 2,400 people running the state up to 120. And then from the Senate, you had a series of smaller councils around the Doge and so on. So I want to...
What jumped to my mind was the thought of the, as you said, the small, the elite ruling the many.
Mm-hmm.
Actually allowing this to happen, with people saying, okay, they made the law, I guess they have the power, they have the money, they make laws, so if they made that law, that's okay, we live with it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because at the time when many of these, the most important moves came towards full oligarchism would be at times of social crisis, mm-hmm. Say that at one point there was a combination, and actually it's interesting because this happened only in the century leading up to the Fourth Crusade, which we'll get into momentarily. But the real shift to imperialism, and this the usury, and the real what we're going to later understand as the Venetian method, was occurring after these oligarchs really close things up. But there was at one point where you had a combination of a plague and a major naval defeat, so a huge social crisis, and the Senate used this as a justification to seize more power from the Great Council and kind of exclude the population more and more, concentrate more power in the hands of a few. And this happens several times. So that by the 16th century, the power is in the hands of really three people.
So, who's the Doge then?
The Doge is the Venetian name for the Duke. Now, there's an interesting quote from one fellow that I looked at. If I can find it here. About the kind of mentality that pervaded in Venice. It was called the most serene republic, the Serenissima Repubblica, the idea that for about 1,500 years, they really never experienced a coup or almost no governmental upsets, or revolutions, or anything like that. Venetians and visitors were to amuse themselves and cease to bother their heads about serious matters. And to make sure that they did so, the agents of the three were increased in number until they became an invisible enemy. It would be difficult to overestimate their number or their omniscience. It can confidently be stated that in every great noble's palace there is at least one informer, and no man in his senses would have talked politics in front of a waiter or servant, pretended priests, your trusted retainer, your own familiar friend. They could all be paid spies. Another quote by another historian. More terrible than any personal despot, because it was impalpable and imperious to the dagger of the assassin, it was no concrete despotism, but the very essence of tyranny. To seek its overthrow was in vain. Those who strove to wrestle with it clasped empty air. They struck at it, but the blow was wasted on space. Evasive and pervasive, this dark, unscrutable body ruled Venice with a rod of iron. That was the Council of the Three. And to give a sense, you had the Senate, 120 people. Then what you had above that was a group of about 24 or 26 ministers of state who would surround the Doge. But within that, you had 10 who, their job was to look after internal security. But over time, they assumed more and more power and took on foreign policy, economic policy. They basically ran the state. And they're the ones that were employing all of the spies. But within the 10, you had a council of 3 who controlled the 10, who controlled this group of 26 around the Doge, which controlled the Senate, and the Senate was constantly being voted back in by the Grand Council. So you can see how this kind of pyramid structure concentrated power really in the hands of maybe a dozen families.
Mm-hmm. And were the three who were at the top, would they have been the richest?
Well, not necessarily the richest. Now, one of the things is these positions were cycled about every 6 months or every 1 year. But the thing is, you would be cycling through a very, very small number of people. Because they, on the one hand, they concentrated all this power in the hands of a few, but at the same time, they were very paranoid about allowing any one or two people to become all-powerful. And there's one interesting thing that he puts in here, in this question of how they fit into a kind of a class or caste system.
Who's this?
It says, with the Venetians and how this oligarchic... Now, think about the corporate structure today and how people fit themselves into this corporate structure of society, right? And they kind of carve out their little place, their region of influence, right? And then it's this very hierarchical system. Right, and the Venetians had this an incredibly hierarchical system.
Who's that quote by?
What
are you reading?
This is not a quote. I can refer, if people are interested, I can refer you to the different material that I took this stuff from. But I will read a quote now. This is from a book that's not important right now. The danger inherent in the imminence of one person had to be overcome by presenting the individual as a member of the system, by stressing his position as an office holder. The visibility the Venetians gave to this relationship is proof of the importance they placed on fitting the individual into the institutional framework. The procurators of San Marco, who were probably the most influential people and looked after the state treasury, were clearly recognizable by the velvet stoles they wore over their red robes. The robes of the senators were also red, but of a different hue. The savi, or this council of ministers, wore blue robes, and those of the members of the Council of Ten had particularly long sleeves. Nobles who held none of the higher government offices had to be content with black robes. The willing acceptance of hierarchical distinctions in such visible form corresponded to the spirit of harmonious unity with which Venetian society was believed to be permeated. But it was actually, a reflection of the continued existence of frictions and rivalries amongst the ruling elite, with each member insisting that he had his own rights and tasks, his own distinctive place. So this is, in a sense, and you can see a reflection of this kind of hierarchical structure in our societies today, right? And the way that people think that they can get ahead, or how they have to operate to get ahead. It's very similar. So, now Venice was formed, was created in 421, and was founded, and it was a bunch of Roman nobility which was fleeing the sack of Rome in 410 by a bunch of, by the Goths.
Mm-hmm. Was Venice a city within Italy as we know it today, back then?
Yeah, well, these were Italian peoples. Italy as a nation didn't really exist in that sense. But yeah.
But Venice was like a nation state in itself?
Yeah, it was a city state, yeah. And Venice is in a lagoon, in a swamp,
yeah.
Really. And it's kind of ironic or fitting that, you know, when Lynn talks about the oligarchy being a slime mold, slime mold came out of a swamp. It works. So, from the beginning, Venice's economy was based upon slavery, the slave trade, usury, and also in dominating all forms of trade throughout the eastern Mediterranean. So that was the basis. And they really had no scruples about selling Christians also into slavery. So they'd sell Christians to the Muslims, the Arabs in the Middle East, and they would sell Arabs, Muslims to Christians or whatnot, or amongst themselves. Also, the Mongols, later on in the 11th and 12th centuries, were huge customers for Venice's slave trade. Now, one of the, I guess from the standpoint of the Venetians, one of their greatest moments was the Fourth Crusade. Now, in 1202, you had the Pope at the time was prepared to send another expedition to the Holy Land. 1201, 1202, they started organizing for this. Now, Saladin had just died, and Saladin had managed to unite much of the Islamic world, and had, yeah?
You know when Islam came about?
Silence.
1400 years ago. Just to say something you used Muslims and Arabs intermittently,
okay, yeah.
But Arabs have been known to be Jewish, Muslim, and Christian.
So Saladin had died, and the Arab world was fragmenting. So he started to organize for a new crusade. Now, the only way that you can transport large numbers of horses, the Pope at the time, I can't remember his particular name. So the Pope is organizing a new crusade, but the crusaders need Venice to ship, to transport them to the Holy Land. Now, the idea of the Crusaders was to first strike against Egypt. I guess Richard Lionheart had, when he came back from his crusade, had advised the Europeans that if they were going to go on a new expedition, that Egypt was the weak point at that time in the East. But so they approached Venice about this. Now, the fellow who is the doge of Venice was named Enrico Dandolo, and he's considered Venice's greatest doge for reasons, as we'll see. Now, Enrico had just been engaged in negotiating a trade agreement with Egypt, I guess the Sultan of Egypt. Now, so the Venetians were not particularly enthusiastic about going to war against their new trade partners. But at the same time, it was recognized that the crusaders themselves would not have been particularly enthusiastic about that. So these negotiations that the top crusaders, the leaders had with the Venetians, were kept secret. But now somehow, the fact that they were going to go to Egypt first was leaked. Nobody knows who did that. But it managed to spread across Europe extremely quickly. And it's still a mystery how that occurred. However, the result was that in 1202, when the crusaders were to assemble at Venice, only a third of the forces showed up. Now, the price was supposed to be 80,000 silver. I'm not sure how that would measure today, but it says 84,000 silver marks, however much. The difficulty was, when only a third of the forces show up, well, you're going to have a hard time coming up with the cash to finance the voyage. And instead of 4,500 knights showing up, and 9,000 squires and 20,000 foot soldiers, they had a third of that. However, the Venetians have a fully fitted armada in their lagoon, including 50 ships of war, which they were going to supply at their expense in return for getting half of the territories that would be conquered. So Dandolo says, we're not sailing. And we're not sailing until we get completely paid up. And the crusaders were 35,000 silver marks short, even though many of the chiefs were selling their own silver, you know, and basically going into debt to finance this voyage. So that poses a problem, because already the crusade is off to a bad start, and it might not even get off the ground. However, Dandolo comes up with a compromise. He says to them, listen, there's this city, Zara, on the coast of Dalmatia, or what is today, I guess it would be in Bosnia. He says, they've been somewhat rebellious lately, and we'd like to get them back. So if you guys help us to subdue Zara, we'll consider putting off the payment of the rest of your of the 34,000 marks until a time when you can actually do this. Maybe after we've conquered part of the Holy Land and we've looted a few cities, you'll be able to pay us back. So, I mean, the crusaders are in a tight spot. I mean, they've agreed to take up the cross and go fight the heathens, right, in their eyes. Now, In doing that, they're about to go and wage war against a Christian city. Mm. Well, when the Pope found out about this, he excommunicated the entire thing, the entire affair. Later, though, when he realized the position that the Crusaders had been put in, he only excommunicated Venice. However, still, that's an ominous sign. So, within a week, they've gone and they've crushed Zara. And, you know, they spent some time looting and pillaging there. Now, as they're holed up at Zara, a fellow named Alexius comes by, who is actually he's the son of a previously deposed emperor of Constantinople. And Alexius says, listen, guys, if you help me get on the throne of Constantinople, I will give you all kinds of money. I'll support you with 10,000 troops, and I'll also finance 500 knights to be maintained in the Holy Land, you know, at my expense. So they're sitting there and they're thinking, well, that's interesting, an interesting proposal. And Dandolo, he has no problem with this. So, they set off for Constantinople. Now remember, this is a crusade, and Constantinople is a Christian city, even though it's Greek Orthodox at the time, it's the Eastern Church. So they arrive at Constantinople. When I read this, I thought it was funny because it's a good example of why you don't privatize your military capacity. About 16 years before this happened, there was a really stupid Byzantine emperor who basically outsourced the shipbuilding and naval capacities of the Byzantine Empire to Venice. So Venice was to build all of Constantinople's ships, maintain them, and serve as the naval defense. So when they show up, you know, whatever ships are there are basically rotting in Constantinople's harbor, and they have no navy. So that was a bad idea. So it's not a good idea to privatize your military, as the U.S. may find out. Well, see, I don't really need this yet. So they show up, and they camp across from Constantinople, and they're just overwhelmed by this city, because it's just church spires everywhere and these massive walls. It was the most affluent city in the world at that time, and I think also the largest. It was huge, and these crusaders had never seen this before, so it was really overwhelming to them. And of course, they're thinking, we're going to wage war against this place. So they're a bit overwhelmed. However, they set up camp across the Bosphorus, and they make their proposal to the emperor. Says, listen, here, this guy, you put him on the throne, you don't have any problems. If you're not prepared to do that, they say, then look to your defense. So there's an initial, they wait, they get no reply. So there's an initial battle, which they wage, and they actually seize part of the city. And they go on, and the emperor, he flees pretty quickly. There was no real battle. I mean, Constantinople only had about 7,000 or 8,000 troops, and this is a really decaying empire at the time. So it's a very easy victory. Dandolo, who's gone on the voyage, he's... the histories say that he was in his mid-70s and stone blind. And he actually led the Venetians into battle. And, the way it worked was that the Venetians went into the harbor, and they were going to assault the city from the harbor, where the walls were the weakest. And then the crusaders would go on the landward side, so they would have a coordinated attack. However, when the Venetians got into the harbor, they were somewhat hesitant to drive their ships up onto the shore and kind of leap down and start doing battle. So the first guy who's actually over the side is Dandolo. Right? The guy is blind, but he's carrying the banner, and that, leads his men on. And so they manage to seize several towers, and at the same time as they do that, the crusaders break through the front gate, and the battle is pretty well over at that point. So now... They installed the new emperor on the throne, and they wait for their rewards. However, there's a problem, because the previous emperor had not been very wise, and the treasury was pretty well empty. So over the next several months, this fellow Alexius goes on, taxing the population. At a certain point, he's even having the gold and the removed from the churches and melted down to pay the crusaders. Well, this was not making the people too happy. So they overthrow Alexius, the population. You have a fellow named Mirzerphilus, who, something like that, some strange name, which I can't remember offhand right now. But they get rid of the emperor, and they start building up their defenses. And the crusaders are still camped on the other side of the Bosphorus. And they take this as a sign that they're probably not going to get any more cash. So they also prepare for war. And from this point onwards, you have another battle. But this time, there's no real holding back. And the Crusaders and the Venetians take the city and spend 3 days pillaging it. Now, I want to read, and again, remember, this is a crusade against the heathens. So this is a direct account from a Christian historian at the time, Nicetas Conaites. He says, "I know not how to put any order into my account, how to begin, continue, or end." And he's referring to the Crusaders. "They smashed the holy images, hurled sacred relics of the martyrs into places I am ashamed to mention, scattering everywhere the body and blood of the Savior. These heralds of Antichrist seized the chalices and the patens, tore out the jewels, and used them as drinking cups. As for their profanation of the great church, Saint Sophia, it cannot be thought of without horror. They destroyed the high altar, a work of art admired by the entire world, and shared out the pieces among themselves. And they brought horses and mules into the church, the better to carry off the holy vessels and the engraved silver and gold that they had torn from the throne. And the pulpit and the doors and the furniture, wherever it was to be found. And when some of these beasts slipped and fell, they ran them through with their swords, fouling the church with their blood and ordure. A common harlot was enthroned in the patriarch's chair to hurl insults at Jesus Christ, and she sang bawdy songs and danced immodestly in the holy place. Nor was there mercy shown to virtuous matrons, innocent maids, or even virgins consecrated to God. In the streets, houses, and churches, there could be heard only cries and lamentations." So, that was what they did at Constantinople. Now, the next thing that goes on is they decide they're going to install one of the Crusaders as the new emperor, and they divide up the whole Byzantine Empire into a set of feudal kingdoms. And what Dandolo does, who's been the architect of the whole thing, is he seizes the majority of the islands and the key strategic trading, anywhere along any of the strategic trading routes between, say, the Black Sea and the Aegean, Crete, Cyprus, places like this. So Venice overnight becomes an empire at this point. And also part of the contract with the Crusaders is that Venice will now have free trade all throughout the eastern Mediterranean, and their main competitors, the Pisans and the Genoans, will be completely excluded. So that's what they were doing. Now, the other funny thing is that many of the greatest relics and artworks in Venice come from Constantinople. Were not commissioned by Venetians, were not built in Venice, but were actually stolen and brought back. You know, and these are the most, the works which they're most proud of.
Hmm. Other right. People's works.
Yeah, were stolen from Constantinople. Yeah, and you've got these four bronze horses also, I believe, which are very famous, which come from Constantinople. So they installed a Venetian puppet, and by the way, they never actually got to the Holy Land. Right. Now, what's interesting is the author's final thoughts on the Fourth Crusade and Dandolo. And I think this is what he's about to say is important to consider with what happens later on. He says, "The Fourth Crusade, if it indeed can be so described at all, surpassed even its predecessors in faithlessness and duplicity, brutality and greed. Constantinople in the 12th century had been not just the greatest and wealthiest metropolis of the world, but also the most cultivated, both intellectually and artistically, and the chief repository of Europe's classical heritage, both Greek and Roman. By its sack, Western civilization suffered a loss greater even than the sack of Rome by the barbarians in the 5th century, or the burning of the Library of Alexandria by the soldiers of the Prophet in the 7th, perhaps the most catastrophic single loss in all its history. Politically, too, the damage done was incalculable. Although the Latin rule along the Bosphorus lasted less than 60 years, after which the Greek Empire was to struggle on for nearly two more centuries, that empire never recovered its strength or any considerable part of its lost dominion. Instead, it was left economically crippled, territorially truncated, powerless to defend itself against the Ottomans. There are few greater ironies in history than the fact that the fate of Eastern Christendom should have been sealed and half Europe condemned to 500 years of Ottoman rule by men who fought under the banner of the cross. Those men were transported, inspired, encouraged, and ultimately led by Enrico Dandolo in the name of the Venetian Republic. And just as Venice derived the major advantage from the tragedy, so she and her magnificent old doge must accept the major responsibility for the havoc they wrought upon the world. Renaissance is extremely important to understand with Venice. And that the ideas which the Renaissance represented, which are typified by the quote from LaRouche at the beginning, was absolutely diametrically opposed to the idea of Venice and what it represented. Now, you had, with the League of Cambrai, you had an alliance formed between every major European power to destroy the Republic. And this author cites part of the actual treaty which was signed to this effect. To put an end to the losses, the injuries, the violations, the damages which the Venetians have inflicted, not only on the Apostolic See, but on the Holy Roman Empire, on the House of Austria, on the Dukes of Milan, on the Kings of Naples, and on diverse other princes, occupying and tyrannically usurping their goods, their possessions, their cities and castles, as if they had deliberately conspired to do ill to all around them. Thus, we have found it not only well-advised and honorable, but even necessary, to summon all people to take their just revenge, and so to extinguish, like a great fire, the insatiable rapacity of the Venetians and their thirst for power. Strong words. So, the League of Cambrai. Now, a bit of history on this. As soon as you had the Renaissance occurring, you had a counterattack, in a sense, from Venice. And through the second half of the 15th century, you had a series of wars occurring in northern Italy, around Florence, Milan, several of the other major cities, where Venice was, in different ways, able to drag, whether it was France or the Holy Roman Empire or the Pope, into a series of conflicts. And because of this, they managed to basically piss off all of Europe, as is expressed in the treaty. So, what triggered this was that the Pope. They actually they took over some cities which the Pope had also had designs on, and this just pushes him over the edge, and he goes out and organizes this league. Now, the way this works, it's. The author spends about four chapters on this, but I'm going to try to keep it.
Can you repeat again what they did to piss off the Pope?
Well, you had several cities. One of them, I believe, was Bologna, which the Pope had claims to, because the Pope was actually a temporal power, was a temporal power at that time, and had a large amount of land. Controlled a large area of central Italy. So, at this time, you had several cities which were nominally under the control of the Pope, but for various reasons had sought the support of Venice. Venice was not opposed to this. Because right, there's another factor that's going on right here. Venice had started to expand territorially into Italy, which is why they were bringing different powers in to fight various wars. They were always very small, so they liked to get other nations to fight their wars for them, much like the British.
Venice was different than Italy?
Yeah, Venice was one city-state within Italy, and Italy was not a unified nation, but it was really just a number of various small principalities. You know, then you had the Kingdom of Naples in the south, you had the Papal States in central Italy, and then France would lay claim to certain portions of Italy. The Holy Roman Emperor in Germany would also lay claim to certain cities.
The Roman Empire.
The Holy Roman Empire, that's like Germany, Austria, parts of Hungary, and also then parts of modern-day Italy and so on. Now, a few things had occurred. For one thing, because of the Renaissance, because of breakthroughs in navigation, the Portuguese had opened up a new trade route around Africa. So now Venice's trade routes were compromised. Right? Venice's real power lay in its ability to control trade between Europe and Asia through dominating the seas. But Portugal outflanked that. So they had to resort to other means to sustain themselves, because they had no industry themselves. They made some glassware, but that was about it. Shipbuilding was the only other thing that they did. So that was not enough to sustain an economy. So they were constantly trying to expand on land, right, through this period, pissing off all their neighbors, and so on. So this treaty is organized. And in 1509, you have Venice at war with the Pope, France, the Holy Roman Empire, England, and Spain.
What's the treaty about?
The Treaty of Cambrai was these major European powers coming together to eliminate Venice, eradicate it.
Pope, France, England, Spain,
The Holy Roman Empire.
Against Venice?
Against Venice. It's a tiny little city. So in 1509, France invades, and there's a battle at a place called Agnadello. Now, the Venetian army was made up almost entirely of mercenaries. And at Agnadello, the Venetians lost quite badly, and the army basically disintegrated. You know, mercenaries are not really, they're not going to be there for you, you know, to the last man. That's not really the way that they operate. So Venice, after one battle, and I guess Machiavelli kind of gloated about this later on, that in one battle, Venice had lost 800 years of territorial acquisitions in one fell swoop. So it's pretty bad. They're holed up in the lagoon. They've lost all of their land, and they're all alone. So the first thing they try to do is they try to bribe the Holy Roman Emperor, Maximilian. And they offer him, they say, the document said 200,000 gold florins. But anyway, that seems like a lot. But that didn't work. They tried that several times, but he was not particularly interested. Then the next thing is they go to the Sultan of Turkey. And they say, hey, listen, you know, look, here's all Christianity against me. They're your enemies, too. So you should loan us a bunch of money so we can fight these guys. But the Sultan doesn't seem to be too interested. So they're running out of options. What they finally resort to is cutting a deal with the Pope. Now, into this situation steps a fellow named Agostino Chigi, who is a banker and one of the Pope's favorite bankers. And what he was primarily was a tax farmer. And he looked after these alum mines, about 70 miles north of Rome. And alum was a crucial commodity at the time, and Venice was the world market for alum. Because Europe, alum, I'm not sure what it was used for. I don't know if anybody else has any idea.
Is it metal or mineral?
Yeah, I don't think the aluminum is from alum.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be used for metal for cookware, jewelry.
Okay. So we'll agree on that. And sorry, I didn't have time to look that one up. It's always the unexpected question. But regardless, this is fairly important. Europe was not producing any alum except at this particular mine near Rome, which happened to be in the Pope's territory. All other alum had to be imported from the Ottoman Empire. So now this banker comes to Venice, and they cut a deal where Venice will ensure that this banker Chigi, who works for the Pope, and the Pope is getting revenues from him, from this mine, has a monopoly on the sale of alum for the next, something like the next 20 years. He also loans them a bunch of money in the meantime. So, now the other aspect of this was that the Venetians actually signed a treaty with the Pope, and they had an embassy of six Venetians go to Rome and actually kiss the foot of the Pope several times, and just do all the, they submitted to him because they had to. They didn't really like it, but they were in a bind where they didn't really have a choice. But now, understanding Venice, you can see that what, and you see in what happens later, what the real idea was. So they cut a deal with the Pope, and then the Pope turns around and a year later declares that the real enemy of Italy is France. So you have a complete about face, and now the situation is the Pope and Venice against France. Spain isn't really involved at this point, though the Holy Roman Emperor, he's asleep at the switch or something like this, but he hasn't really become involved yet. So now there's a series of battles, kind of goes back and forth. And over the course of this first year, this is 1511 now, the Pope manages to get Spain on board, England also joins, and then he also gets the Holy Roman Emperor to sign on. So now you have a league where it's everybody against France. But it doesn't seem to do too much good because the French king has a very talented nephew who takes charge, and a fellow named Nemours, who wins a series of battles, but at Ravenna, which is a little bit south of Venice, he ends up getting himself killed. And this, if he had stayed alive for another 6 months, the war would have been over at that point. However, things didn't turn out that way. So when he dies, the general that's appointed in his place hesitates and doesn't, and France loses all its momentum. And eventually, within several months, France suffers several defeats and retreats back to France. So now you have this new Holy Alliance, or this Holy League, which decides to start splitting up all of the territory which France had conquered amongst themselves. So it's the Pope and, Maximilian and so on. England hadn't really become involved. You had several other cities then also. I think Ferrara, the Duke of Ferrara, was also seizing some land. But I guess the Pope didn't like Venice that much, and they tried to keep Venice out of the cutting up of the cake. Well, Venice wasn't too happy about this, And at the same time, there was a dispute that was arising between Venice and Maximilian. Is anybody getting confused yet?
Who's Maximilian?
Maximilian. Maximilian's the Holy Roman Emperor.
Oh. So I'm still, I guess, with the Venice thing. It's its own territory, separate from the Roman Empire. And,
yeah. Oh. I have a small map. Maybe, you know, people can. You can kind of see. You can maybe pass this around. I'll give you an idea of the territory that Venice controlled, and all that area which it lost after Agnadello.
So Venice was a city, but when you say Venice, you don't just mean a city; you mean an area.
Yeah. Well, when it controls territory, then yeah, that includes that. But I mean. I tend to think of Venice as really the city-state, because during this war, I mean, it was, you know, cities were changing sides sometimes, you know, half a dozen times over the course of the war.
So
it's primarily Venice the city-state, though, like the Venice in the swamp.
So after 1509,
mm-hmm.
after the Pope declared France the enemy, the Pope went with Venice, and then so everyone else joined
yeah.
the Pope. Because they all believed in the Pope or whatever. And then, is that right?
Yeah, that's
so
right.
Venice,
so
fine. Venice had managed to get itself out of...
Yeah, it managed from being alone to being with everybody else except France.
Yeah.
How did they pull that? Again, I missed that.
Well, there's it got this alliance. First of all, it bribed the Pope.
So basically. The first one was to bribe the Pope.
Yeah. You know, so with his deal through Chigi.
But how did he that? Was that the metal thing? Was that
yeah, the alum. Because see, the whole idea is that you don't bribe the Pope directly, but you set up a deal where for the next 20 years, or however but not only that, but his mines, he's going to have a monopoly on the sale of alum in Europe for the next 20 years, and he owns the only mine, and Venice is the only market, so.
But it's greed.
Yeah, so this is how it works. So it's not a... They don't directly give them the money, but it's a bribe nonetheless. So then from there, you know, you've got... and we're going to look at some Venetian ambassadors later and how they operate. You know, he starts saying, hey, the guy was Julian II. He was the Pope. You know, these French, you know, they're all over the place. You think these guys are going to leave in a couple of years? Maybe we should go after them. You know, we're just a little city. That kind of stuff, right? And they start poking, and they say, hey, you know, we should go after these guys. I'm on your side. I'm your friend. You know, we're getting along now. We've got this alum deal. So that's how it, this is the way that they work.
So when they attack the French, the territories outside of France that they conquered, like
in northern Italy.
They don't go like attack. They
no,
go
all of the warfare is taking place in northern Italy. Well, it's like Bush is a Christian. I mean, Venice was excommunicated many times. That was one thing I brought. The Pope in the build-up to the war also excommunicated Venice at the same time in 1509, before the war started.
Mm-hmm. Just a little clarification. At that time, you know how there are cities that have rise and fall, and within a country, you have capitals that change place and follows the money and the power. Power is usually people who, like Rob was saying, certain selected families or persons. The money pot circles around that small ring, and wherever that ring moves in places, that becomes the new capital city. Now, Venice at that time, where Rob was saying, had a lot of the trade merchant. You also have to think about that time, there wasn't a lot of discovery routes were through sea, and mm-hmm. it was through the, they were very well established with their shipbuilding. Mm-hmm. It was very solid. And so that was why they were high on the scale, right after, we all know about the Roman Empire, but that was on the decline. It seems that there are a lot of
questions.
No, that's because Venice not only attracted money and governments at that time through trade, which generated, but it also started appealing to migrants. People started coming in. That's where the arts and other things started thriving. That only gave Venice on the facade that it was a growing city. And so that's how it had a lot of influence there.
Mm.
Religion came into Venice, and then that's the power play.
Mm-hmm.
So politics and economics.
Yeah, and they had, there's an area of Venice was called the Arsenal, which was the dockyards. And they, I think the number I heard was something like 16,000 men were working in the shipyards of Venice. And it was considered the biggest factory in Europe for many centuries. So that was their major power.
They were one ship a day.
Yeah, something like that.
And
yeah.
So just to say why Venice was able to keep its power for some time is because they married into alliances from other countries. So Venice
mm-hmm.
ruling families would like to marry into royal French families, and that's how you have political allies, and it was
mm-hmm.
able to keep itself from war. And it built itself against the Roman, even the great Roman Empire and the whole
mm-hmm.
Empire.
It's like the Demarais
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Marrying into the Chrétien family.
Or the
Chrétien
marrying into the Demarais. Yeah.
Yeah. Either way.
Yeah.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that constantly, and in this war, saved Venice a number of times was the fact that these islands were about 2.5 miles off the coast, so they were out of cannon range, and as long as they could keep their ships, and there's only a small number of entry points into this lagoon, they're pretty well impregnable from any kind of attack. So even though they could lose their entire army at Agnadello, you know, it was still almost impossible for anybody to really get at them. You know, even as weak as a position as they would be in. So, all right. So where were we? We were dividing up the territory that France had conquered. And Venice comes into conflict with the Holy Roman Emperor over certain cities in the area of Venice that Venice also wanted to control. So Venice doesn't like this deal. So it just so happens that they end up very shortly to be in the autumn of 1512 in an alliance with France against the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. And and several other powers. So then in 1513, Julian II dies. You get a new pope. Julian II, yeah, he was the pope. So now France invades. You know, the Swiss get involved. They defeat the French army. Then the Pope calls in Spain. Spain and Venice have a battle, you know, so it's just crazy, you know. They have a battle. Venice loses, right? Her lagoon saves her again at this point. Like her land forces have been wiped out a second time. But nobody can actually touch her. But she's saved by her French ally, who invades with an army of like 110,000 men. There's one final battle where the Swiss are defeated, and that pretty well ends the war. Now, the ironic thing is that the war ends, you've had literally every combination of alliances between the Pope, Venice, and France, who are the major players in the war. And in the end, the treaty which is signed fully restores the territories that Venice had initially lost at Agnadello. So, This method of shifting alliances and bribery and so on that Venice engages in, you see how they just kind of shift and weave their way through it.
It's like a snake.
Yeah. But one of the other interesting things is that as soon as Venice gets the alliance with the Pope, when it throughout the war, every alliance that it's in, it's the ally which is doing the bulk of the fighting. It's not Venice. Venice just kind of sits back at that point. Says, yeah, I've got, you know, I'm there for moral support. You know, like all these crusades, Venice was supplying the shipping and the naval support, but, you know, and getting paid to do it, and, you know, saying, hey, look at that, we're, you know, doing something. We're real Christians. But they never really participate in it, but they get a share of the loot. So this is how Venice went through and survived the League of Cambrai. But now there's a in the concluding section, there's also a few notes, I think, which this fellow mentions, which are useful to think about where Venice is coming from. So her confidence was shattered. More than once, with what seemed like the whole of Christian Europe ranged against her, Venice had been brought to the brink of the abyss. She had escaped, but in this new, uncongenial, uncertain order of things, who could tell when the next crisis would come, or what results it might have? Was it enough to rely on her geographical position to protect her, or even on the generally accepted need to preserve a balance of power in Italy, which should ensure that if any one state attempted to absorb her, the others would rally to her defense? Quite possibly it was. Yet she knew, too, that her future well-being, if not her actual survival, would henceforth depend not on her admirals, her merchants, or her mercenaries, but on her diplomats. And so the great age of Venetian diplomacy began, an art which she pursued with the application and thoroughness that her people had always shown in matters which they considered of prime importance to the state, until her diplomatic prowess became a legend throughout the civilized world. It was not the sort of diplomacy that makes friends. On the contrary, it tended to sow fear and distrust as much as friendship, relying as it did so heavily on spies and agents, on secrecy and intrigue, on the sinister and mysterious deliberations of the Council of Ten. No wonder that, as the century progressed, Venice came to assume, at least in the minds of many Europeans, an aura which we might associate with the more melodramatic forms of Renaissance tragedy. What was perhaps less generally understood was the underlying reason why the Venetian methods of diplomatic intelligence were fearsome. Venice was herself afraid. How does a small city, oligarchic city-state survive in a world dominated by the nation-state?
That they would search what was the, you know, the soft deal of everybody.
The
point where they could introduce it and get them like on the side, bribing them, whatever.
Profiling.
But really like, well, more buying people up. Using money and buying people up.
Now, around the end of this war, actually 1515, which is, I think the League of Cambrai ended in 1516, you had the...
Sorry. Okay. I was just going to say, because you said, in a world dominated by the nation state,
mm-hmm.
which, because we were really discussing that, are you referring to that the first sovereign nation state? Being developed in France, or
And also England, yeah.
You know, we are talking about nation states after the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648.
Oh, are you? Did you jump to that time yet?
No, I mean, you had, this was, like at the end of the war, France managed to mobilize, France was the great power on Europe at the time,
Which war, this same war? The
League of Cambrai, yeah. France under Louis XI,
yeah.
Around 1460 or 61, I think he came to power, had formed the first nation state. Mm. Henry VII followed after that. So this was where Europe was moving.
Yeah.
And the fact that you know, Venice was recognizing that its maritime power was waning, that it was going to have a very difficult time holding its land, you know, the land that it was expanding onto in northern Italy, when you have these huge powers around, right? The fact that it barely survived this war, and only by, you know, the kind of shifting that it had done, it recognized that if it was to survive, it was going to have to change its modus operandi. So this is where, but at the same time, with the Portuguese opening up these trade routes, these alternate routes to Asia, the Venetians also recognized that the kind of the focus or the center of world trade, particularly the European trade, was shifting also away from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. So it's not an accident that in 1515 they send one of their top ambassadors to the king of the court of King Henry VIII. And this was, I was really happy to come across. This is an article which one of our members produced. I think it was called Venice Methodology of Evil. And it was written by a fellow named Donald Fow, which you can, you know, you could probably search for. I'm going to use part of it. But he actually was able to analyze and look at real reports, actual reports of Venetian ambassadors who were reporting back to the Senate, the Venetian Senate, about what they were doing. And what he shows is that these were not, you know, some kind of, oh, well, I went to the country and saw some very nice wildlife and blah, 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 and I went and had tea with this fellow, and that's not what it was about at all. So we're going to go, I'm going to quote from that a little bit, and you'll get a sense of this idea of Venetian intelligence and these networks and how this operated. So his name was Sebastian Giustinian, and he goes to the court of King Henry VIII. And in his final report on his return to Venice, these are some of these are sections that Fow quotes. Now his he devotes one paragraph to the king. Says, he is affable, gracious, harms no one, does not covet his neighbor's goods, and is satisfied with his own dominions. That's the king. Okay. So the next person that he discusses is the Lord Chancellor of the king, Cardinal Wolsey. And he says of Wolsey, he is of low origin. He has two brothers, one of whom holds an untitled benefice, and the other is pushing the fortune. This cardinal is the person who rules both the king and the entire kingdom. On the ambassador's first arrival in England, he used to say to him, quote, His Majesty will do so and so, end quote. Subsequently, by degrees, he went forgetting himself and commenced saying, We shall do so and so. At this present, he has reached such a pitch that he says, I shall do so-and-so. He is about 46 years old, very handsome, learned, extremely eloquent, of vast ability, and indefatigable. He alone transacts the same business as that which occupies all the magistracies, offices, and councils of Venice, both civil and criminal. And all state affairs likewise are managed by him, let their nature be what it may. He is pensive and has the reputation of being extremely just. He favors the people exceedingly, and especially the poor, hearing their suits and seeking to dispatch them instantly. He also makes the lawyers plead gratis for all paupers. But now, this is, he goes into something that somewhat seems kind of strange. He says, he is in very great repute, 7 times more so than if he were Pope. He has a very fine palace, where one traverses 8 rooms before reaching his audience chamber, and they are all hung with tapestry, which is changed once a week.
Wow.
He always has a sideboard of plate worth 25,000 ducats, wherever he may be, and his silver is estimated at 150,000 ducats. In his own chamber, there is always a cupboard with vessels to the amount of 30,000 ducats, this being customary with the English nobility. He is supposed to be very rich indeed in money, plate, and household stuff. Then Justinian turns to account or to list the income of the cardinal. He says, the archbishopric of York yields him about 14,000 ducats. The bishopric of Bath, 8,000. 1/3 of the fees derived from the Great Seal are his. The other 2 are divided between the king and the chancellor. The cardinal's share amounts to about 5,000 ducats. By the New Year's gifts, which he receives in like manner as the king, he makes some 15,000 ducats. Now, if you add that up, that comes to 40,000 ducats and a bit. Maybe 42,000. Do you remember how many ducats of silver he had in his house?
A couple hundred thousand.
Something like that, yeah? Strange. It's awfully strange. It's like somebody working at McDonald's owning a house in Westmount. You got to wonder how that works out. Right now, as a Fowl makes a good point, he says, imagine you're a Venetian senator, you're hearing this report. You know, and you know, you're looking at this figure is being profiled for you quite extensively, right? And you see, so you're thinking, of course, you're not that nice of a person yourself. So what does Venice try to do? And what does the ambassador propose we do to Mr. Wolsey? He says, Cardinal Wolsey is very anxious for the signory to send him 100 damascene carpets, which he asked several times and expected to receive by the last galleys. The ambassador urged the Senate to make this present. This present might make him pass a decree in our favor, and at any rate, it would render the cardinal friendly to our nation in other matters, for no one obtains audience from him unless at the 3rd or 4th attempt. Right, so what has this fellow done? He said, here's the guy running England, and here's his weakness, and here's how we're going to turn him into an agent of Venice. And that's an actual report. Now, it becomes important also later, but this is not something I'm going to get into in this class, but because these Venetians, starting at this point, begin a project to penetrate the court of King Henry VIII. It's actually a Venetian agent who is crucial in orchestrating his divorce of the Catherine of Aragon, which ends up leading to a whole series of religious wars over the course of the 16th century. And also to, of course, King Henry creating the Anglican Church, and to a whole influx of Venetian operatives and also bankers. However, that's something I'd refer, you know, you can look at some of our publications on that. or others, but there's not going to be time for that tonight. So that's a sense of Venetian diplomacy in the post-Cambrai period. Now, there's another aspect. Like I said at the beginning, the best historians or the best accounts of Venice are actually the poets, right? Both Schiller and Shakespeare, as well as, Faust. Can't believe I forgot his name.
Goethe?
Huh?
Goethe?
No, there was,
Percy Shelley.
There's the Dante.
I've completely forgotten his name. Anyway, there's a fellow who wrote The Jew of Malta, and a few other plays looking at this Venetian method as well. But these fellows were all very interested with Venice. Schiller wrote a book called The Ghost Seer on this question of the Venetian method of profiling and manipulation. There was Othello, which is what we're going to look at, by Shakespeare, which is also an excellent example of the Venetian method. How many of you are familiar with Othello? No?
What?
A little bit? Okay. Well, I encourage you all to read this play. It's fantastic. People, at first they read and they think it's just like, oh, this is just Shakespeare writing a soap opera. But it's really much more profound than that. Oh, okay, that's kind of cool. So we can choose the
yes, sir. The
act and scene. All right.
What do you want?
We'll just leave it at that for now.
Maybe.
So I'm just gonna do just give you a brief idea of what this is about. There's one scene in particular which we'll take a look at and we'll read through. To give you kind of a sample of the play, okay? So, the idea is that there's this guy, Iago. Iago is considered one of the most villainous characters in all of literature. And, you know, people constantly ask the question, why is this guy such a bastard? You know, why is this guy so evil? He's so evil. And it's really, you just... this guy's such a bastard. I still ask myself questions about that. So it starts off where Othello has married the beautiful Desdemona. Now Othello is this Moorish general, a mercenary in the employ of Venice, and he's won several battles for the Venetians. All right, so he marries Desdemona. And Iago is his third in command. And Iago is pissed off because this other fellow named Cassio has been chosen in Iago's place. But there's another thing. Iago thinks that Othello slept with Iago's wife. He has no proof, but he's not particularly concerned about that. He says, I'll treat it as if it's proven. So Iago manages in the first act to draw a fellow named Rodrigo into his schemes, and what they plan to do is cause the downfall of Othello. And the way he gets Rodrigo is he says, Rodrigo's in love with Desdemona. So he promises to get, you know, and say, hey Rodrigo, don't worry, you want to sleep with Desdemona, no problem, we'll arrange that, you know, but you're gonna have to help me out. Well, maybe... No. So, what Iago does is... Here's how it goes through. Iago makes Rodrigo believe that Cassio and Desdemona are lovers. Mm-hmm. So the two of them plan to get Cassio drunk one night when Cassio is... in charge of the nightly watch. This is all taking place on Cyprus. So they get Cassio drunk. Rodrigo picks a fight with him. All right, and he and Cassio get into it, and because of this this activity. Cassie also ends up getting into a fight with another official of the island. And for all of this and the fact that he's supposed to be second in command to Othello, Othello fires him. All right? And Iago, he has this tendency to always come on the scene and be the savior of the situation. He calms everybody down. He's everybody's friend. This is very important. He's everybody's friend. Everybody, they all call him Honest Iago. And they all come to him when they have problems. Because he's so honest and he's so helpful to everybody. You know, everybody just feels so free to take him into their confidence. So now, once Cassio loses his job, oh, it's like, man, I'm screwed. What am I going to do? And he goes to Iago and says, man, Iago, I'm just in, I don't know what to do now. I've lost my job. I'm totally disgraced. Iago says, don't worry. What you want to do? We'll go talk to Desdemona, and we'll get her to go plead your case with Othello. Because, you know, I mean, Othello, like, he just got married. He's, you know, kind of is not really thinking straight. So I'm sure she'll be able to convince him. So Cassio's like, yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, we'll do that. And so, you know, Iago goes and talks to Desdemona, and Cassio goes and talks to Desdemona, and she says, yeah, no problem. I can do that. You know, she's a very... very nice person, very, very honest. And so, you know, okay, we're going to get things worked out. Now, while he's doing this stuff, he goes and talks to Othello. And he says, Iago. Iago's the main character in all of this stuff. He's the one that seems to be taking all of the decisive action. So, Iago goes to Othello and he says, well, you know, you see how Cassio and Desdemona are talking and stuff? Or have you heard, like, I kind of heard something. I don't know. Actually, you know what? I shouldn't say anything. I'm just, forget it, Othello. I've just got some concerns. And Othello's like, what are you talking about? Well, no, I shouldn't say, you know. It's like, he's like, come on, man, you know, you're supposed to be my friend and stuff. No, it's, listen, we'll just, you know, leave well enough alone. It's just, it's better, you know. And anyway, he gets Othello all interested, right? And then he's just saying, well, you know, it's like people should be honest, you know, and we should, you know, and I'm sure Cassio was honest. And it says, Othello, what do you mean? And Iago, and he says, well, I'm sure Cassio seems honest.
Oh.
Right? And then this kind of thing, and Othello just, he's starting to freak out. He's like, what are you talking about? Like, well, you know, it's, okay, since I'm your friend, and I mean, you're my commander, and I have to be honest with you, and I'm only saying this because, you know, I care for you so much, but I think there might be something between Desdemona and Cassio. You know, and Othello gets quite angry at a certain point, right, because, I mean, he's being challenged, he's just gotten married, and of course, he's a little bit insecure. And Othello has a tendency to get jealous quite easily. So then Othello says, well, this is no proof. I mean, what, you know, and he kind of takes Iago by the throat at some point, and he's like, come on, you got to show me proof. He says, well, there was this one night when Cassio and I were, I'm not sure how this happened, but they were sleeping in the same bed. But in a purely platonic and he says, you know, and at a certain point Cassio was deep in sleep and he was in the middle of a dream and he rolled over and he took my hand and he said, oh Desdemona. And then and then he said something like, oh, God, why do you have to be married to the Moor, you know, or something like, damn the Moor, and, you know, he says, this is Cassio in his sleep saying this, and Othello just totally loses it. Oh. I mean, you know, he's been so worked up, and he's being played, right? Iago has, knows what it will take to manipulate Othello and get him really going. And then he says, I have further proof, besides the dream and besides them, you know, I've been seeing, you know, there's one time when Cassio takes Desdemona's hand and he's very friendly and he kisses it several times and, you know, so that he uses this kind of behavior, which is just, Cassio's a ladies' man. You know, so he has this tendency, but it doesn't mean... So Iago plays it up. So it says, there is this other thing. The other day, do you remember that handkerchief with the strawberries embroidered upon it that Desdemona often carried with her? And Othello says, yeah, I gave that to her. That was like the first gift that I gave her, and that was given to me by my mother, and she said that, you know, if I gave that to a woman and she ever lost it, that would, like, be the end of everything. Kind of thing, right? This kind of superstitious stuff. And he says, well, I swear that just the other day I saw Cassio wipe his mouth with it.
Oh.
And, man, that just puts him over the edge, right? And he says, show me proof. I need proof. If you're lying, I will kill you. And he says, yeah, don't worry. I'll arrange it. And listen, I'm sure that just the other night, Cassio and Desdemona, as he says, he makes a bunch of lewd jokes about the sexual act. But anyway, he says, I'm sure just the other night they slept together. So listen, what I'll do, I'll set up a meeting between Cassio and myself, and I will get him to tell me all about it. And you can hide just off to the side, and watch his. Response as I question him about his activities with the sweet Desdemona, and this is the scene that I want to go through to see how he sets this whole thing up.
Which now
I think this is it's Act 4, Scene 1. And what they come to agree on is that the handkerchief, if they can prove the question of the handkerchief, then that will be sufficient for Othello in his mind. Hmm. So you've got it here? So there's going to be... Who wants to read?
I know, thanks, Dick.
Come on.
I can read.
It's really small.
Two real.
Yeah, put it bigger.
Okay, I'm Iago.
Can people read that? Somebody, people can come up a little bit, too. Is that actually a glass of water?
Glass of water for
your
house.
Okay, thanks. Can I be Othello?
Okay, you can be Othello.
Yeah, sure. You a person?
Yeah. Have you read this before?
Oh, you okay, so?
Actually, scroll down a little bit. Let's scroll down. Keep going a bit. Just want to make sure this is the right one. Let's read the whole scene because I think it'll be good to see how he's playing Othello in this also. So there's two people for now. So why don't we start?
Okay. Will you think so?
Think so, Iago?
What? To kiss in private?
An unauthorized kiss?
Or to be naked with her friend in bed an hour or more, not meaning any harm?
Can you situate the context? What am I supposed
to do? This is just... Iago, I guess, in the previous scene, has probably just been telling Othello about how Desdemona and Cassio are lovers. Mm-hmm. Right? And I believe at this point, what he's doing is like get a good mental picture, right? But Othello is looking for proof. You know, and I think right here, as we'll see later on, it's like, you know, how can we catch them in the act? Like, do you really want to catch them sleeping together? Is that, do you need that kind of definitive proof? So we'll see how it goes. But this is the context. He's building them up to a scene where they're going to have this little conversation with Cassio.
Naked in bed, Iago, and not mean harm? It is hypocrisy against the devil. They that mean virtuously and yet do so, the devil their virtue tempts, and they tempt heaven.
So they do nothing. 'Tis a venal sleep. But if I give my wife a handkerchief...
What then?
Why then 'tis here, my lord? And being hers, she may, I think, destroy it of any man.
Bestow it on any man.
By any man.
If at any time, like for explanation, because it's Shakespeare and stuff, we can stop and explain.
Because it's a Bulgarian accent.
She is protectress of her honor, too. May she give that?
Her honor is an essence that's not seen. They have it very oft that have it not. But I for the handkerchief.
By heaven, I would most gladly have forgotten. Thou saidst, it comes over my memory, as doth the raven over the infected house, boding to all. He had my handkerchief?
Oh, what of that?
That's not so good now.
What? If I had said I had seen him do your wrong, or hear him say, as knives by such a broad, who having by their own importunate suit, or voluntary dotage of some mistress, convey or supply them, cannot choose but they must...
Have he said anything?
He had, my lord. But be you well assured, no more than he'll answer.
What hath he said?
Faith. That he did. I know not what he did.
What?
Why?
With her?
With her. On her. What you will.
Lie with her? Lie on her? We say lie on her when they bell her. Lie with her? That's wholesome. Handkerchief? Confessions? Handkerchief? To confess and be hanged for his labor? First to be hanged and then to confess? I tremble at it. Nature would not invest herself in such shadowing passion without some instruction. It is not words that shake me thus. Pish! Noses, ears, and lips. Is possible? Confess! Handkerchief! Oh, devil!
Work on. My medicine work. This crevious fool is cap. And many worthy chaste dames, even thus, all guiltless. Meet reproach. What? Oh, my lord, I say, Othello!
Oh.
You're Cassio.
Pascal. Enter Cassio.
I could be Cassio.
No, Cassio!
What's the matter?
Diego?
You are.
My lord, it's fell into a epilepsy. This is his second fit. He had one yesterday.
Rub him about the temples.
No, for beer. The lethargy must have his quelled curse. If not, he foam at mouth and by breaks out to savage madness. Look, he stirs. Do you withdraw yourself a little while? He will recover straight. Then he is gone. When he is gone, I will on great occasions speak with you. Except Cassio. How is it, General? Have you not hurt your head?
Dost thou mock me?
I mock you? No, by heaven. Would you bear your fortune like a man?
A horned man's a monster and a beast.
There's many a beast than in a populous city, and many a civil monster.
Did he confess it?
Good sir, be a man. Think every beer fellow that's but yoke may draw you with you. There's a million now alive that nightly lie in those improper beds, which they dare swear peculiar. You see is better.
Your case
is better. Oh, tis the spite of hell. The friend's arch mock to leap a wanton in a secure coach and to suppose her chaste. No, let me know. And knowing what I am, I know what she shall be.
Oh, thou art wise, 'tis certain.
Stand your unwell apart. Confine yourself but a patient list. Whilst you were here overwhelmed with your grief, a passion must insulting such a man. Cassio, come hither. I shifted him away and lay good excuse upon your ecstasy. Bide him anon return, and here speak with me. With which he promised, do but uncave yourself and mark the clear, the glib,
the jibes,
and notable scorns that dwell in every region of his face. For I will make him tell the tale anew. Where? How? How oft? How long ago? A horn he had, and is against to cope your life. I say, but mark his gesture. Mary, patience. Oh, I shall say you are all in spleen, and nothing for man.
Dost thou hear, Iago? I will be found most cunning in my patience, but dost thou hear, most bloody?
That's not amiss, but yet keep time in all. Will you withdraw?
Now will I question Cassio of Bianca, a housewife that by selling her desires buys herself bread and clothes. It is a creature that...
This is Iago talking.
Oh, yeah. It sounds weird for me to say that.
Oh,
yeah. Now I will question Cassio of Bianca.
Because, wait, sorry. So Othello just went to go and hide, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said, okay, you go off, calm down a bit, be patient.
Yeah, man,
Chill out. I'm going to bring him over. I'm going to get him to tell the story.
But watch his reaction from far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bianca is Cassio's girlfriend.
This not amiss, but yet keep time in all. Will you withdraw? Otello replied. Now I will question Cassio of Bianca. A housewife that by selling her desires buys herself bread and clothes. It's a creature that dates on Cassio. As tis the strumpet's like to beguile many and beguiled by one, he, when he herself of her, cannot refrain from the excess of laughter. Here he comes, re-enter Cassio. As he shall smile, Othello shall come mad. And his bookish, jealously must construe poor Cassius' smile, gesture, and light behavior. Quite in the wrong. How do you know, Lieutenant? Cassius, where is Cassius? Your Cassius.
The worser that you give me the addition, worse whose want even kills me.
Play Desdemona well, and you are sure of it. Speaking lower. No, if... Oh, speaking lower, this I don't know. No, if this suit lay in Bianco's power, how quickly show you speed?
Alas, poor Caltiff.
What's the name? Caltiff? It's I'm not sure it's a term for a woman, I think.
Look. Look how he laughs already.
I never know woman. Excuse me. Okay. I never know woman love man so.
Alas.
Oh, this will tell.
Alas, poor rogue. I think I've faith she loves me.
Now he denies it faintly and laughs it out.
Do you hear, Cassio?
Now he importunes him to tell it over. Go to. Well said. Well said.
She give it out that you shall marry her. Hey, her. Do you intend it?
Do you triumph, Roman? Do you triumph?
I marry her? What? A customer? Prithee, bear some charity to my wit. Do you not think it so unwholesome?
So. They laugh that wind.
Faith, the cry goes that you shall marry her.
Prithee, say true.
I'm a very... villain else.
That's what I don't say, yeah.
Have you scored me well?
This is the monkey's own giving out. She is persuaded I will marry her. Out of her own love and flattery, not out of my promise.
Iago beckons me. Now he begins the story.
She was here even now. She haunts me in every place. I was the other day talking on the sea bank with certain Venetians, and thither comes the bauble, and by this hand she falls me thus about my neck.
Crying, oh dear Cassio, as it were, his gesture imports it.
So hangs and lolls and weeps upon me, so hails and pulls me, ha ha.
Now he tells how she plucked him to my chamber. Oh, I see that nose of yours, but not that dog I shall throw it to.
Well, I must leave her company.
Before me, look, where she comes.
'Tis such another fits you. Marry a perfumed one. Oh, enter Bianca. What do you mean by this haunting of me?
Oh, there is. Someone want to be Bianca?
Bianca?
Let the devil and his dam haunt you. What did you mean by that same handkerchief you gave me even now? I was fine, fool, to take it. I must take out the work, a likely piece of work that you should find in your chamber and not know who left it there. This is some minx token, and I must take out the work. There, give it to your hobby horse, wherever, soever you had it. I'll take you out, no work.
How now, my sweet Bianca? How now?
By heaven, That should be my handkerchief.
And you'll come to supper tonight, you may, and you will not come. Come when you are not, when you are next prepared for.
That's it.
Okay. After her.
Faith, I must. She'll rail in the streets else.
Will you soup there?
Faith, I intend to.
Well, I may chance to see you, for I will very faith speak with you.
Prithee, come, will you?
Go to, say no more.
How shall I murder him, Iago?
Did you perceive how he laughed in his voice?
Oh, Iago!
And did you see the handkerchief?
Was that mine?
Yours by this hand. And so see how he praised the foolish woman, your wife. She gave it him, and he had given it his horn.
I would have him 9 years a king! A fine woman! A fair woman! A sweet woman!
Nay, you must forget that.
I let her rot and perish and be damned tonight, for she shall not live. No, my heart is turned to stone. I strike it, and it hurts my hand. Oh, the world hath not a sweeter creature. She might lie by an emperor's side and command him tasks.
Nay. That's not your way.
Hang her! I do but say what she is. So delicate with her needle. An admirable musician. Oh, she will sing the savageness out of a bear. Oh, so high and plenteous wit and invention.
She is the worst for all this.
Oh, a thousand times, and then, oh, so gentle a condition.
Yeah, too gentle.
Nay, that's certain, but yet the pity of it, Iago. Oh, Iago, the pity of it, Iago.
If you are so fond over her iniquity, give her patient patent to offend. For if it touch not you, it come near nobody.
I will chop her into messes. Cuckold me.
It is full in her.
With mine officer.
That's full.
Get me some poison, Iago, this night. I'll not expostulate with her, lest her body and beauty unprovide my mind again. This night, Iago!
Do it not with poison. Strangle her in her bed. Even the bed she had contaminated!
Good! Good! The justice of it, please, is very good.
And for Cassio, let me be his undertaker. You shall hear more by midnight.
Excellent. Good. Trumpet within. What trumpet is that same?
Something from Venice, sure. This Lubavico. Come from the Duke and see your wife is with him.
So that's good.
Whoa.
So yeah, that's a everybody. That's a great part. So, what goes on from here? Well, it's pretty clear. Iago's got him into a position where he's about to kill Desdemona. Mm-hmm. And it moves very quickly from this point forward. Where? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're gonna choke. I just want to make sure you understand so far what's happening.
Okay.
Cassio was the second or third in command.
He was second in command
and
to.
And the third in command wanted to get
Iago.
Yeah. Who was the third in command?
Iago.
Oh, I thought. Okay. Mm-hmm. And who were you talking about before the play went on? I thought Iago talked into trying to get rid of his buddy to help him get rid of Cassio.
Yeah, Rodrigo was a buddy of his who he uses to first get Cassio fired.
Okay.
Rodrigo, and then Iago has told Rodrigo that Desdemona and Cassio are in love, so that's why Rodrigo needs to help him get Cassio out of the way. And what Iago goes on from here to do is get Rodrigo to help him murder Cassio that evening, or try to make an attempt against his life. So that's where Rodrigo comes in. He's kind of the henchman, Iago's henchman. then you have So Iago's whole purpose was he thought that Othello had slept with Iago's own wife, but also that he got he was not chosen to be second in command. So he's got this resentment that's built up, and he's such a bastard that he's going to take out way, you know, it's not an eye for an eye. It's beyond that. So where it goes from here is Iago puts Rodrigo up to murdering Cassio that night. Othello goes on to murder Desdemona, strangle her. And once he's killed her, you have, as he's doing that, Rodrigo and Iago make an attempt on Cassio, but it goes wrong. Cassio and Rodrigo get into a sword fight, and Rodrigo gets wounded. Cassio is the actual soldier, Rodrigo is just a nobleman. But Iago comes up behind Cassio and slashes him in the legs from behind, and then takes off. You know, so nobody knows he's been there. then he comes back and he says, "Oh, what's going on? What's going on?" And Cassio's like, "Oh, my leg." It's like detached, and you know, there's all these other people coming, and then he says, "I think the villain went off that way." And Iago catches up with Rodrigo and he stabs and he kills Rodrigo. He's like, "Villain!" You know, he gives him the knife, and you know, so Rodrigo is like, "What the hell?" And he just falls over and dies. And then Iago says, "I got the villain. Here he is." And he'll breathe no more. So Iago is still not suspected. He managed to escape that. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't Cassio know that Rodrigo was like in front of him and somebody slashed him from behind?
He knew somebody slashed him, but he didn't know it was Iago.
But he knew there was a second person.
Yeah. Yeah, he just said, "Oh, I've been overtaken." But he saw Rodrigo and... So Iago kills Rodrigo, but Cassio is not killed. Now other people are on the scene, so that whole attempt has now been botched. Mm-hmm. But then what happens, Iago's wife, whose name is Emilia, she makes a few brief appearances. She comes into the room, or she comes on the scene just after Othello has finished strangling Desdemona. And she freaks out and she starts crying, "Murder, murder, murder." So Iago and a few other people in the story, this guy Lodovico, which was just coming on the scene when we finished, mm-hmm. and another fellow, Montano, who had been in charge just before this whole play kind of takes place, they come into this room and they see Desdemona dead, and there's Othello, and there's Emilia saying he just killed her. And then Othello starts trying to explain himself, and he says, "Well, look it, she was sleeping with Cassio." And everybody's like, what are you talking about? And he says, "She gave him my handkerchief. I saw it." And Emilia is just like, "The handkerchief? And the handkerchief? My husband had me steal it from Desdemona and give to him." And everybody's just like, "What?" And Othello is just saying, "What?" And he just realizes at that moment what he's done, mm-hmm. and that he was played the whole time, but he's already destroyed. And Meanwhile, Yag was looking at his wife and saying, shut up, shut up. He pulls out his sword and he threatens her and he says, that's enough. But she just keeps, and she completely starts to spill the beans on all of this stuff and this whole deal with the handkerchief and, you know, what Desdemona was trying to do. And Othello realizes that Desdemona was completely innocent. And everybody realizes at the same time, because this is the first time people came together and talked to each other. Mm-hmm. For the entire play, you realize that Iago is the go-between for everybody. Like, nobody's actually talking. He's like, completely in control of all the communications between people. Or he's in their presence, so he's able to channel the direction of the conversations. But finally now, people are coming together, and he's lost control of the situation. And the truth comes out. So what he does, he kills his wife, and then he takes off. So she dies, right? And he takes off, and they capture him. In the meantime, Othello also takes a stab at Iago. He's completely shattered, and then Othello kills himself when he realizes exactly what he's done and how he's been manipulated. And anyway, Iago is brought back in at the end, and the Montano and Lodovico, these two Venetian nobles, they basically tell him, we're going to do you, hope you're ready for the rack. You know, and they promise him all kinds of excruciating pains for his actions. And that's how it ends. So, the issue is, like Pascal mentioned earlier, it's a question of the Venetian method that we saw with that diplomat, right, which we see in Othello, which is also present in The Ghost Seer by Schiller, right, where Iago profiles everybody. He knows Rodrigo's weakness. Rodrigo, you know, he's thinking not with his head, right? He knows the jealousy and what he can twist in Othello, right, to make him respond as he wants. He puts Cassio in a position where he's, in a sense, the go-between between Cassio and Othello. So he's shaping Cassio's actions, right? And one of the, what's important about this is this idea of creating a controlled environment around somebody with the idea of brainwashing. Like when we talk about brainwashing, the idea is how do you create an environment around a person and control the environment that the person is operating in, so that you shape their decision-making process and that you shape the way that they respond to their environment. Like you put them in a position like Othello where all of his information is coming from one source and all of his choices, his potential choices of action are coming from one source, in a sense. And he's put all his trust in a single person who is actually his worst enemy, right? And that person, because he's completely isolated Othello from everybody else in the play, is able to manipulate him like nothing, right? So this is how Venice works. This is the Venetian method, and this is the whole idea of brainwashing. Right, how do you control the mental environment and the kinds of choices? Now, the other thing is when you shock somebody, and this is research done by the Tavistock Institute during World War II, recognized that from studying the effects of war on the human mind, that if you submit somebody to a series of traumatic experiences, after that, you know, that people talk about post-traumatic shock or whatever, this idea that after that, after an experience of an extreme kind, people will become open to suggestion. They're more open to being influenced. You know, in a sense, they become irrational or less rational. You know, and if you think about 9/11 and the effect that had on the American people, And then what the Bush administration was able to do immediately after that occurring, and the actions they were able to take, which if 9/11 had not happened, and the psychological blow to the American people that represented, would they have been able to pass the Patriot Act without it even really being read by the Congress? Right? So this is the Venetian method. Now, I think from from that ambassador's report, it's also clear that this question of the psychological profiling was present. You know, they were aware. Shakespeare wrote the play in 1603, 1604, which coincides, incidentally, with this takeover that was occurring. Yep?
Do you know when the English language came about?
Silence. The agent in our midst. All right. Around the 1600, the Venetian state had been retiring its debt. And apparently, in some of our research, we discovered that in 1600 there was something like 16 million gold ducats of cash in Venice at the time. Normally this would have been debt that the state owed to the various noble families. Because a lot of the, whether it was the military or the trade ventures, the various endeavors that Venice was involved in, was all state-run. So it'd be like a, like all the ships would be owned by the state, but then the nobility would be purchasing the like shares. You know, they would be renting ships and stuff like that. So, but anyway, the state generally carried a lot of debt, and this was another way of keeping the noble families tied to the state and keeping a kind of a unity. But the state started to retire all this debt, and by 1600 it pretty much completed that process. Now, question is, why? You know, why would they be doing this, and what is that signal? Well, at the same time as this was happening, you had the creation of, a few years later, creation of the Amsterdam Bank, which was, I guess, became the central bank of the Netherlands, became one of the primary banks where all of this Venetian money went to. Like, there's a reason that LaRouche talks about the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. That it comes from this, and it's in this period, as they were noted, as the trade, you know, the center of trade was moving to the Atlantic, that the Venetians moved their money, their finances, out of Venice, which was no longer a strategic place to run an empire from, and they move it to Amsterdam, and somewhat later to the Bank of England. It was also created in the 17th century as a locus of Venetian money. Now, Shakespeare writes this in 603, recognizing that the country is being taken over by a bunch of usurers. And another good reference for the kind of battle which went on between this kind of more Republican-oriented faction within Britain and these Venetian networks has been documented by a fellow that used to be with us. He died, I think, in the 90s. How the Nation Was Won by Graham Lowry, which is a really fantastic work, yeah, on the origins of the American Republic, going back to the late 17th century in England. So you can get more information on it there. But that's when he wrote it, conscious of the process that was going on.
How do you know that Shakespeare knew about the Venetians and all of that, and it wasn't just like some dude like playing against his Othello?
Well, first of all, there was a quote earlier at the end of League of Cambrai, I read a quote where basically it was Venice was recognized for these kinds of activities. Like, it was well known. This whole idea of the Council of Ten was commonly known. And and this activity of usury was, you know, it wasn't really concealed thing. I mean, people knew what was going on.
Shakespeare hinted too, right? He said Venetio. Hmm? Is that implying Venetian when he said Venetio?
Venetio?
Yeah.
How do you mean?
When he said it was in the act of the play.
Venetio?
Venetio, and to me, I thought it was Venice.
Well, the play is called Othello, the Moor of Venice.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, Iago himself is Venetian. If you think about the fact that you have three of the key classical playwrights, Schiller, Shakespeare, and then this guy that I just can't remember his name for the life of me, even though I've read some of his stuff. They were all looking at this method, and I think there's a reason that they were situating these plays of, like, Hamlet. It wasn't Hamlet, the Prince of Venice. You know what I mean? So he didn't just pick it on a lark or anything like that. And this is, you know, these people are always, they're writing for a very specific reason. And they have, it's also, think about Shakespeare, the Merchant of Venice, also dealing with this question of usury and the concept of justice that Shylock has, where he's like, well, you know, we're not going to get it. But if you want a backup to what you have with Othello is the Moor of Venice, or the Merchant of Venice, which is with this question of usury and whatnot. So I think it was definitely a conscious decision. So now this shift that occurred also in the diplomacy was a conscious decision on the part of these Venetian networks. But there is another aspect to this which is really crucial, and which Othello, the issue in Othello brings up. And a good question to ask is, in this question of tragedy, like, what is it that allows powers or individuals like Othello represents, what allows them to be manipulated? Mm-hmm. Right? Why don't they see what's happening? You know, what's actually what is not there in their mind? What are they not thinking about? Or perhaps it's the way that they're thinking which is the problem. And this fellow Donald Fow, he asked LaRouche this question, and maybe I will I'll read briefly from this, because it's insightful what he says about this question of Venice. The response from LaRouche: the Venetian method is the method not of taking sides, but playing sides against one another to one's advantage, like Iago. You go into a country, you go among a people, you go to an individual person, and you corrupt them by knowing the principle of corruption which is embedded in every person. That principle of corruption is the person's self-ego, as an autonomous ego, as a microcosm in struggle against the macrocosm. Not the individual as a part of a macrocosm, or as a reflection, right, of the society, nor the individual as in the image of God, but the individual as a sensual creature in a war not against not all, but the all, to correct the ordinary reading of Hobbes. Once you understand that method, you can see the examples of how that method is consciously applied by the Venetians in philosophy and elsewhere. Right? To cultivate this sensuality, through sense certainty, by making sense certainty primary, and convincing people that sense certainty is primary, is the principle of evil. To convince people that that which affects their senses and their appetites and their impulses, as Adam Smith echoes this outlook in his theory of the moral sentiments, and against his and again in his treatise on free trade, The Wealth of Nations, is the principle of evil. So this is the idea. You're going to go to the lowest part of the individual that you've targeted. And how do you corrupt a person? You go, is it greed? Right? Is it lust? Is it jealousy? You're going to find whatever is worst about them and weakest in their character, and you're going to twist that. Like Iago twists Othello, right? How he twists Rodrigo. You know, or in a sense of if you're naive, like Desdemona, how he takes Desdemona and that naivety and uses it against her. Because she doesn't understand what's actually occurring. So this is a question of epistemology, right? The philosophy of knowledge. How do you know things? How are you thinking? So now, if by the end of the 16th century, you're looking at a world that is increasingly dominated by nations and kingdoms are growing, from the effects of the Renaissance has been an explosion in scientific progress and technology. How are you going to counter this? Because the idea of man that's embodied in the Renaissance is what will destroy you as an oligarchy, right? Which in the fundamental principle of the Renaissance was the idea of imago viva Dei, right? That the human being can discover truth, can make fundamental breakthroughs in science, can actually elevate the state of humankind, right? That sense of optimism and that the human being is a power in the universe, is not subject to the irrational whims of Mother Nature, right, or some pagan god like Zeus. So you have a faction develop in Venice in the late 16th century around a fellow named Paolo Sarpi. Are any of you familiar with Paolo Sarpi? Yeah, this is why we call them Venetians. Well, Paolo Sarpi is quite the interesting individual, and this is who we're going to take a look at now, because by understanding the role of Paolo Sarpi in history, it's much easier to understand what is occurring at this moment, whether it's in the schools, in the Middle East, or wherever you look on the planet. So now, on to Mr. Sarpi. There's something interesting about him. There's this common thought in the 17th century that it was the time when a man was approaching death that he would become honest, and that he would state his most honest opinions and beliefs. And in true form, Sarpi was in accordance with this. Because when he died, his protege and his closest collaborator was a fellow named Mecanzio. And Mecanzio circulated two versions of Sarpi's death. One was circulated in Italy for the Catholics, which claimed that Sarpi died a pious Catholic. Another was circulated amongst the Protestant states, claiming that Sarpi had, in the end, died a Protestant. The same fellow wrote both. Rather strange.
What's that guy's name again?
His name was Mecanzio. Now, Sarpi himself, in a moment of honesty, said the following. My character is such that, like a chameleon, I imitate the behavior of those amongst whom I find myself. Thus, if I am amongst people who are reserved and gloomy, I become, despite myself, unfriendly. I respond openly and freely to people who are cheerful and uninhibited. I am compelled to wear a mask. Perhaps there is nobody who can survive in Italy without one. Now, Sarpi, one of his main tasks, now, it's important to understand, this guy was a Catholic monk, nominally. But he actually spent the majority of his life working to actually... Well, here's a... now, this fellow is quite good. He was a Canadian author that I happened upon, who... one of the problems is Paolo Sarpi has never been translated into English. So there will be several direct quotes from him that are translations, but there's also several sections which I'm going to read, which are kind of like a summary of certain major points of his philosophy. So, but that's kind of what we have to work with. Now, something interesting he says is, for Sarpi, as the author believes, was hostile not merely to the Counter-Reformation papacy, but to Christianity itself. Sarpi spent his life developing what he thought would be the philosophical basis for a completely secular society. Because his war was against an idea, right? And he spent his life actually subverting the Catholic Church, and he was promoting Protestantism. Not because he liked Protestantism per se, but there's a problem with the Protestant faith, which is that it claims, and this is where the fundamentalism comes from today, that man is saved by faith alone. Right? That you don't have to do good works. Right? Faith, there's no relationship between faith and charity. Now, this is important if you're a Venetian usurer. Or you're some German prince who doesn't feel that, you know, kindly towards his people. Where you can know you'll go to heaven if you believe, as, you know, Rue should joke the other time. You know, so it's based upon purely faith. But he promoted Protestantism as a way of... creating religious conflict. And there are other aspects of this and other Venetians that have been involved, which I've looked at, but and I urge you guys to look at it too, but the documentation is a bit slim, but there do seem to be indications that whether it was the 30 Years War that led to the Treaty of Westphalia, or generally the religious warfare in Europe at the time, that you had Venetians that were actively working to promote these conflicts. Again, as a way of, how do you deal with a world of increasingly powerful states and larger national institutions, right? They decide to go into this mode of using religion as a way to subvert things. So you have Sarpi promoting Protestantism, and a fellow we're not really going to talk about, but you should keep his name in mind, his name, Contarini, who was one of the key guys in organizing the Counter-Reformation, which is kind of a crackdown on the Catholic faith, and was used to kind of foment this strife between the Protestants and the Catholics, particularly in Germany. But Contarini was also a member of the Council of Three at a certain point. So he's a very high... He was a cardinal. He was also ambassador to the Pope at one point, and there's in the article by Donald Pfau, there's some excerpts from his reports, his ambassadorial reports to Venice on how he was manipulating the Pope at the time. So it's interesting to look at.
Hey, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just clarify for a moment? So Sarpi was against the Reformation.
Yeah, he was. He was really anti-Catholic and against the Pope. But yeah, it was the thing was, is that he was attacking the church, but what he was really attacking was an idea.
Yeah.
He simply attacked the church because that was the institution which reflected that idea. Hey, Guillermo, you should grab a few EIRs before you go. You got it? Okay.
So, this idea that man is in the living image of God.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, so he goes up against the Reformation and Protestantism, or the break from, the break up from Catholicism.
You had this guy Luther, who was very possibly influenced in his ideas by Sarpi and his circles. And Luther was the one that initially broke from the papacy, right, and formed the Lutheran faith in Germany. But then, as a response to that, you had this. So Luther was part of the Reformation, but then you had this, within the Catholic Church, you had a counter-reformation, which I'm not sure on all the details, but there was a series of councils that went on trying to clean up their act and kind of change the way that the church was functioning. It was like a crisis management thing, like, holy shit, half of Europe is splitting from us. So, but, I mean, I haven't done enough work on the details to really comment too much on it.
And, Contarini?
Mm-hmm.
What did you say he was up to?
Contarini was a cardinal. He was at one point ambassador to the Pope. He was also, for several years, the ambassador to the Holy Roman Emperor in Germany, who was Catholic. But many of the princes that were under the Holy Roman Emperor were becoming Lutheran. So you could promote a lot of turmoil if you provoked conflicts between, because these princes were very independent. And I would refer people to the history, Schiller's History of the 30 Years' War, for really, and the Wallenstein trilogy, for an account of this kind of hatred and how these religions were played by these princes to achieve various political objectives. So what else was it? Contarini was also a member of the Council of Three Venice.
Oh, the top.
Yeah.
Guys.
So I mean, if you're part of the Council of Three, you're a Venetian intelligence agent.
So basically,
right?
Okay.
By.
So yeah. Was the deal that he was trying to split up Catholicism and Protestantism?
Well, there's this term that I think Lynn uses, and maybe some others. This idea of a gang counter gang operation, where these Venetians say, hey, we want to create religious wars. We want to promote division within, and use a religion as a basis for destabilizing Europe, like the Crusades. The Crusades also was another form of religious conflict that the Venetians were actively promoting and transporting troops and financing this stuff. So they say, well, how do we do that? Well, let's promote Protestantism. Sarpi's writing away and actively promoting Protestantism and these ideas, developing a philosophy which undermines the church. Then on the other side, you have Contarini, who is right in the highest levels of the Catholicism, but also within Venice's hierarchy, who is promoting the Jesuits, and the Jesuits are like one of the nastiest operations in history. They're a Venetian operation, yeah. I mean, in the history of the 30 Years' War, what you realize is that it's the Jesuits who oppose this fellow Wallenstein. You have this 30-year-long war. Halfway through the war, you have a general who's capable of stopping the carnage, which ends up costing something like 12 million German lives. And the Jesuits, who want to promote the war, conspire against Wallenstein because the Jesuits have the ear of the Holy Roman Emperor, and Wallenstein is the general of the Emperor. And Wallenstein has an opportunity to end the war, and at that same time, he's being organized, counter-organized against within the court of the Emperor by these Jesuit factions. And that's historically documented by Schiller. But Contarini was basically the guy that helped. He was the one that went to the Pope at the time and asked the Pope to let Ignatius Loyola start this new Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. So he was integral to getting them to their creation. But I want to move on from that. Yeah, there's here's one short quote from Sarpi, and this is important to think about. The end of man, as of every other living creature, is to live.
Can you say that again?
The end, or the purpose of man, as of every other living creature, is to live.
Life is life.
So, in terms of, now I'll give you a bit of a sense. This is, like, I kind of think of this as Sarpi versus Christianity. So he first of all says that, he develops this, he's a materialist, first of all. He, in one of his essays, he has like a, creates a list of false hypotheses. And one on that, this list explicitly is the immortality of the soul. It's not true. And he says, everything is based upon sense perception. All knowledge comes from sense perception. The entire universe is material. Soul does not exist. Because since everything is material, you can't have and all knowledge comes from your senses. How can you have a soul? Because if the body dies, then the soul is screwed. So even say there's a soul that exists, it can't really exist in any way that is cognitive, because it has no way to sense the world outside of it. So he creates this kind of, he develops this idea of nature. And then this author says, it's not surprising then that he dismisses the idea of God as irrational. He argues that we believe things have a supernatural origin when we do not understand their cause. So, having rejected all rational arguments for God's existence, Sarpi is free to give belief in God a purely psychological explanation. He says it originates in human ignorance and is man's desire for things that are contrary to nature, and even things that are impossible. To compensate for their own sense of frustration, men invent an omnipotent God, capable of doing what they are unable to do. Their unwillingness to confine their desires to what is naturally useful is the root of all human misery. True felicity, on the other hand, lies in the realization of the ideal of indifference, the ability to be unperturbed by external events and the blows of fortune, restricting one's desires within the circle of natural necessity. Right, so can't remember.
When you see somebody stoic, is that like a stone,
kind of miserable.
Yeah,
I think that idea of subduing your passions, your emotions, and things like that, and just living very moderately and humbly. But of course, Seneca, one of the most famous Stoics, he was a multi-millionaire. whatever. He owned all these palaces and gardens. He was the advisor of Nero. He's, you know, his defense was like, yeah, but I'd give it all up in a minute. Anyway.
It's like China, the billionaire communist.
yeah, exactly. So here's another interesting... So what you want to think about is, what is the conception of man that Sarpi is underlying what he's saying? Now, this is a direct quote that was translated. The great majority of mankind, when they act well, do so more out of fear of eternal damnation than out of hope of eternal bliss. For punishments are more familiar to us than an eternal happiness of that sort. In order to make this myth of eternal damnation beneficial to all men, whatever category they may fall into, the legislator, seeing how inclined men are to do evil, lays it down that the human soul is immortal, for he is concerned with the common good. His commitment is to utility, not to truth, and his objective is to make men act virtuously. The doctor, too, misrepresents many things in the course of his treatments of the sick. And if men were healthy, or at one with themselves, such fictions would not be necessary. So, now, when I was reading this, and I was reading his thoughts on Christianity, I thought about Nietzsche. And I thought about... How do you corrupt and destroy the whole idea of what Christianity and these ideas are supposed to represent? It's like Nietzsche says in Beyond Good and Evil that, you know, us oligarchs, you know, the nobility, we've been duped. So we've been duped into believing this idea that the meek shall inherit the earth, right? That there's something wrong with exerting our power over anybody that we can. You know, and that... You take the church and you say this idea of religion is just, you know, the opiate of the masses. Right? And that there's nothing wholesome about it or uplifting, right? But since human beings are inherently evil and wicked, right? The babies are not angels. Then you've got to give this stuff to them. And this is not only an attack against the church, this is an attack against Plato. Because you think about this idea of the noble lie. That Plato has, it's like, you know, I mean, sometimes you have to lie to protect somebody or whatnot. I mean, there are situations that everybody is put into on that. The question is, what is your intention to help the person or is your intention to hurt them or harm them in some way or control them? So Sarpi takes that conception of Plato and twists that, and we're going to come back to the implications of that later. Right, and he goes on to develop this, where he says, just as God is a reflection of man, so man's worship of God is a reflection of human social relations. Moreover, religion cannot remain a purely private affair. It is communicated, if imperfectly, from one man to another. And because of its importance in human affairs, it is inevitably brought under the control of the state. The state's first task is to adapt religion so that it meets the needs of both the common people and the intelligentsia. This is done by employing creeds and mysteries, which can be understood and interpreted in different ways by the different groups within society. The people have then to be persuaded to accept the resulting religion, and miracles are often faked for this purpose. Such an established religion can have beneficial psychological and social effects, but also harmful ones. In this respect, it is like any other medicine. Right, so this is really a... And the author says he's the first guy to come up with this secular idea of religion, right? And how religion is just a construct used to control masses of people. So, now, when I was reading this guy. At a certain point, one name popped into my head. Leo Strauss.
I've heard that name.
Yeah. There are a few people here that haven't heard of Leo Strauss before. Leo Strauss is the father of the neoconservatives. He's the philosophical father of the neoconservatives. He was a friend of Carl Schmitt, who was the German who paved the way for Hitler's dictatorship, and the idea of the unitary executive, which Bush and Cheney are implementing right now. Schmitt helped Leo Strauss get a job at the University of Chicago, where George Shultz worked, and Milton Friedman, and a bunch of other people that went on to collaborate in the privatization and destruction of Chile. And a number of the neoconservatives are the spawns of Strauss, who studied with him at the University of Chicago back in the years after the Second World War. Now, one of the things that Strauss advocated was the idea, we've recorded, and the Children of Satan, was it one?
One.
Children of Satan one, we dug up a lot on these guys, and Harper's later followed our lead and published a big report on the Straussians as well.
Stephen Harper.
No, Harper's Magazine. Yes, Stephen Harper. Silence. But what Strauss would... You would have these events. You would have two Straussians debating each other, and they would have different arguments, and they would argue against each other that Strauss... It's like, Strauss told me this. And the other guy says, no, he told me this. Right? And they're arguing over the same point, and Strauss had taught them different things.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting.
Now, think about Mackenzio writing two different death certificate, literally death stories, or accounts of Sarpi's death. And the fact that Sarpi says, I'm like a chameleon. Now, I'm going to, there's a section here that I'm going to read from, which I think is going to solidify this in people's minds.
Which goes from who there? From Strauss?
I should have clarified that. This is from Sarpi. This is a summary of basically propaganda. He had extremely developed ideas about the use of propaganda. Can I get some more water? In order to understand Sarpi's attitude to polemical argument, our starting point must be Sarpi's emphasis on the limitations of human reason. His philosophical writings were called the Pensieri Philosophici, which include notes on the relativity of human conceptions of beauty, of morality, and of knowledge. The Pensieri sulla religione, thoughts, I'm not sure what the sulla means, but anyways, thoughts on religion, end with a few notes attacking the Aristotelian and Christian concepts of natural law. It says, if moral principles are learnt through habituation, as Aristotle argues, then men's understanding of natural law cannot be governed by reason. Nor indeed can it be shown to be reasonable. Do unto others as you would wish them to do unto you is contrary to nature. Nietzsche.
It's Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Can you repeat it?
He says, you know, quote unquote, do unto others as you would wish them to do unto you, right? That is the primary teaching of Christ, or one of the primary.
Yes.
Right? He says that is contrary to nature. For it takes no account of the need for self-preservation. Moreover, people's wishes are so varied as to provide no consistent standard of behavior. The only law of nature is that the strong always rule over the weak. The only sensible principle is to consider everything in terms of its implications for yourself.
He was finding Nietzsche.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I forget who was promoting Nietzsche.
Well, Nietzsche is implicit. All of Nietzsche's arguments have just been, or his fundamental, the philosophy of Nietzsche is right there.
Okay, but it's good to mention Sarpi was like, he was kind
centuries
of considered revolutionary in these ideas, right?
Yeah. Yeah, never, you've never, there's no recorded, there's nothing written before this guy on these kinds of ideas. He's like, he takes the fundamental basis of Aristotle, which is sense perception, and also, Aristotle is also pro-slavery. He said, you know, some are born to rule, some are born to be ruled. So he takes elements of Aristotle, but he kind of does away, because Aristotle was a really bad scientist, if you could call him a scientist, right? I mean, he had really a lot of bad ideas. So they do away with a lot of the junk that Aristotle had concocted, but they keep the essential principle. So even though he may attack Aristotle or certain points that Aristotle was promoting, he fundamentally agrees with Aristotle on the points of truth, knowledge, and things like that. The axioms of Aristotle's system are preserved, but he changes certain things to make it more in accordance with. He takes Aristotle and he modernizes Aristotle, but it's much more developed.
So this is kind of like the Renaissance of evil.
Yeah.
The counter-Renaissance.
Yeah, exactly. The anti-Renaissance.
So what years again was this? Because all these other people that we're talking about now, that came out of the Enlightenment, like Nietzsche and these guys.
Yeah.
Sarpi, they're taking off Sarpi's lead.
Yeah.
Way back in...
We'll get to that. Sarpi was writing in the last few decades of the 1500s, in the early into the 1600s. I think he died in 1623. So, this skepticism regarding human reason is apparent in Sarpi's attitude to study. He maintains that one can never hope to find anything in books that one does not already know. Books exercise the mind, but do not teach. Study itself should only be pursued for the pleasure it gives. For knowledge is never more useful than ignorance. This is great. Socrates' most admirable characteristic was his ability to play at marbles with young children.
God.
In short, one should always be suspicious of the supposedly rational and prefer the avowedly useful or pleasurable, for there is always an objection to be made to any argument, and your own views may change tomorrow. For this reason, you should respect other people's views, no matter how foolish they seem, for one day you may share them. Meanwhile, all you can do is accept your own opinions for what they are and live according to them. And then this is an actual quote, the source of men's miseries is the illusion of knowledge, end quote.
Jesus.
Now, this next one is something that I came across in some of our other writings. So, despite Sarpi's contempt for human reason, he believed it to be capable, if rightly employed, of reaching certain sound conclusions. The best summary of his position is perhaps, he divided into numbered sections, but is the following. This is a direct quote. There are four methods of philosophizing. The first employs reason alone. The second, sense perception alone. The third employs reason first, and then the senses. The fourth begins with sense perception and uses reason to build upon it. The first method is the worst, because it gives the results one wants to begin with. The third is bad, because often what is misrepresented, as one would like it to be, right? If you start with reason and then use your senses. The second is sound, reason, sense perception alone, but poor. For it teaches you little and gives knowledge of beings rather than causes. The fourth is the best that in this poor life we can hope to have.
Which one was that?
Sense perception and then reason to build upon it. Like a logical deductive system.
Yeah.
In this poor life, this miserable life. Sarpi is then, in the first place, an empiricist. And as he mentions on the first page of the book, arguably the father of the Enlightenment, as we'll get to in a little bit.
Hmm.
Now, here's the catch. You're a philosopher, you've realized the truth, right, that everything's just crap and you can't know anything, and truth is relative, and it's all about getting pleasure. And life is really just a savage battle to impose your will upon others. Now you've got to get this ignorant mass of people who would never understand that. You know, they keep thinking you're supposed to be nice to people. You've got to get them to go along with this whole idea. So how can you persuade others to accept this truth?
That there's no truth.
Well, that's the truth, right? That there is no truth?
That's his truth.
Yeah, but truth is all relative, so it's really just sophistry.
Mm. So how do you get the... How do you reverse all the brainwashing that the religion has imposed upon the masses?
Mm. Yeah, that's right. You gotta deprogram and then reprogram them.
Re-brainwash.
Yeah.
Damn believers in God.
You gotta reformat everybody's reformat the disc. So the starting point for Sarpi's treatment of this problem is the belief that merely to present the truth straightforwardly will do no good. It says, just as healthy food is harmful for the sick body, so it is for the sick mind. Consequently, it is often best to leave well enough alone, especially if one is dealing with beliefs which are held to be socially necessary, like religion. However, if the false belief has damaging consequences, one must resort to constructive falsehood. We have already seen that Sarpi believed that in such matters the end justifies the means. The constructive falsehood. So what does he mean by that? Sarpi recognizes two techniques which need to be combined in this process of re-education. First, the sick man's conviction must be undermined by attacks on the principles which underlie them and some of the particular conclusions which are drawn from them, like the fact that you are made in the image of the Creator. The purpose of this is to render the mind receptive to new ideas. Second, the false beliefs which are being attacked must be counterbalanced by an opposing, equally false set of beliefs.
Counterbalanced by an equally false belief.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be two false beliefs.
Yeah.
So he's not teaching the truth yet. Is he?
No, and doesn't intend to.
Okay.
Just as in medicine, health comes from the balance of contrasting humors, as he thought, so intellectual health can be reached by balancing contrasting opinions. Thus, sound arguments against the fallacious standpoint are combined with false arguments in favor of a contrasting standpoint. In this way, the individual's attachment to falsehood is broken down and he is prepared for a knowledge of the truth. But a truth which, apparently in Sarpi's case, must be false. Sarpi is thus equipped with a theory of propaganda, but he remains unhappy about any attempt to improve other people's opinions, which leaves one open to attack for not sharing in common prejudices. This is Strauss again. The best advice is to express popular views in public while retaining one's philosophical views intact in private.
We come across that.
Right? Again, it's the idea, I am not... there's a line in Othello where he says something like, I am not who I seem to be. This idea, right? The Iago wears many masks. Like Sarpi dies both Catholic and Protestant. Sarpi's views on the techniques of persuasion thus provide, potentially, a key to the understanding of his propagandistic activities. First of all, they tell us that Sarpi believed one should often espouse beliefs which conflict with those one really holds, if one thinks they will serve to undermine popular prejudices. But second, he believed that one should, as far as possible, express oneself in conformity with popular opinion. In view of Sarpi's own statements, it would be unwise, therefore, to adopt a literalist approach to his words and deeds. And then, because this is, you know, one thing that this fellow comments on a lot is that every other person that has ever done work on this guy has never been able to reconcile Sarpi's philosophy with his activities. The fact that his own personal writings are completely opposed to the historical accounts of his activities in life. Hmm. And this fellow is making the point that, well, when you actually consider what he's actually saying in his philosophy, there is no contradiction. Because the way he acted is what he advocated and acted in accordance with his, you know, he acted in accordance with what he was advocating.
At least he wasn't a hypocrite.
Well, it's funny, but he was.
But he was.
He was and he wasn't. In private he wasn't, but publicly he was. And, you know, he said, when, as is often the case, these words and deeds seem to be in conflict with themselves and each other, one should ask whether they may not be intended to act together as different aspects of a mental therapy. Now, considering the time you lived in and the fact that you're going through 150 years of religious war, this is something interesting here. To take one example, is Sarpi's often expressed desire to see Protestant troops invade Italy. Or to take one example, is Sarpi's often expressed desire to see Protestant troops invade Italy evidence of his commitment to Protestantism? In the light of his philosophical writings, it might rather be taken to reflect his desire to see Catholic power counterbalanced in a Venetian way by Protestant power. The religious conflicts in France had led, after all, to the growth of the politique movement, and it was generally held to the spread of moral atheism. Might not religious conflict of this sort be a necessary precondition for the establishment of a secular society? So now, this is Sarpi's philosophy, but, you know, Sarpi was actually the teacher of Galileo, right, who was put up as one of the great scientists and who was used to kind of subvert Kepler and eclipse Kepler in his times.
Take its place.
Misguide him?
I mean that Galileo was turned into a bit of a celebrity because at one point he was brought before the Inquisition over his... Jesuit-run operation to basically attack heretics, you know, witches, but also people who are proposing new ideas.
Well, didn't it start with a reaction from the Christians in Spain to get rid of the Muslims, and in that same tide, they did get rid of all heretics, they didn't think with them, and then followed into the colonization of South America.
Yeah, you had it. It was like a really widespread thing for a long time. Yeah, I think, I'm pretty sure it started in Spain, too. Yeah, with Torquemada, we talked a little bit about him. So,
okay.
So he was, because of his ideas on science and whatnot, the thing was, Kepler, and so he was made into this, like, European celebrity. You know, he's the scientist struggling against the dogma and the irrationality of the church, stuff like that. But apparently, Sarpi and him built, Galileo built this telescope. It was apparently built, you know, by Sarpi, stuff like this. Like, and they, so they made this. But Kepler himself had been brought before the Inquisition, even before Galileo. And he and Galileo were in correspondence, and Galileo, in apparently in a lot of his lectures, was stealing ideas from Kepler, not acknowledging that they were Kepler's ideas.
Yeah, he never answered a single one of Kepler's letters either. Like Kepler kept him like asking for advice, and he just attacked him in like lectures and stuff.
So he was kind of a somebody who was used by Galileo as a counter to real physical science, but Sarpi had this salon in Venice, which became a lot of the young nobility were part of this salon, and my thoughts is that this salon, this kind of intimate group, this is where Sarpi was pushing his ideas out, right, and they were disseminating through this society, right, through this kind of a secret society which they had going, and there's proof that this existed. Galileo was a part of that. But also, this guy Mackenzie, Thomas Hobbes, was a student of Sarpi and Mackenzie. And Thomas Hobbes was the fellow who advocated absolutism, right, that the sovereign must have absolute power. Right, Sarpi also advocated that idea. Right, and Hobbes was the guy who came with this idea that society is, it's a battle of each against all, right? So what you need to have a sovereign who imposes his will upon the society to establish order, you know, and create some kind of social cohesion through that power, and that you can have nothing which impedes that power. It's got to be absolute. And of course, that's the kind of, if your conception of man is a beast who is just out to exert power over others and is completely irrational and driven by, you know, pleasure and pain and this kind of stuff, right? Law of the jungle, you know, you have to impose your will because there's no other way that you're going to be able to control people. So that's the kind of idea that was emanating out. but when you think about the fact that, you know, you can see Nietzsche, you can see Hobbes, also a lot of Locke's ideas on humanity. Like, the entire British Enlightenment and the French Enlightenment was fundamentally based upon Sarpi and his concepts of the nature of man, sense perception, all of this stuff that we just went through here. This is the basis for the movement, empiricism. Now, remember in the last webcast, Lynn was really emphatic on this point of empiricism and how much of a poison this is in our culture. Now think back to Othello, right? What was Othello's problem?
Method of thinking.
Yeah. Right, what was the problem of everybody in that play? And just like if you read the Ghost Seer, what is the problem with this fellow who the Venetians profile and then manipulate and turn into an unwitting agent? Their method of thinking is flawed. Right. And empiricism is the Venetian counterattack to the Renaissance and the promotion of this kind of science, and something which you can also look into is the role that a number of Venetians played in promoting people like Isaac Newton, Voltaire, and this whole, that organized a number of salons in Paris, and also organized networks in Britain to promote this particular idea.
who came out of the same cadre in Venice. Right, so you can find these connections. And the way that this has been promoted through the British Empire in particular, right, as these Venetians move over into Britain, you know, they become squatters in the city of London. And they promote this idea. Why? Because how do you control large numbers of people? Well, the easiest way, it's a lot easier if the dictatorship doesn't have to be obvious, right? Like if you can, in a sense, get people to put on mental shackles, or you simply take from them a certain way of thinking.
Prison without bars.
Yeah.
See the bars, you're gonna fight that.
Yeah, exactly. But if you can't see them, right, then you're a lot easier to control. Like the fact of Euclid and the kind of geometry, or a bunch of you guys here in school, right? A few of you. Think about the way your classes are. If you took history classes, if you took geometry, if you took science, any of these subjects, there's an unseen or unspoken axiom in all of education. And sometimes it becomes a problem to communicate to people because they don't see it, right? Which is the whole point, is that there is no truth, right? It's just your opinions. One opinion is as good as the other. You're in that history class. You got to write that essay, you know, and all the teacher wants is you to give your opinion, but you've got to back it up with other people's opinions.
Yeah.
So it can't really be your opinion because it's just got to be a reworking of other people's opinions. Otherwise, it's not valid. You know, don't have any of your own ideas, right? In math class, we're not going to tell you, we're not going to explore the process or the experimentation which occurred right around some, like Kepler, right? Some phenomenon which we don't understand or some scientist was trying to figure out.
Just have to memorize the formula.
Yeah, don't relive the experiment. Memorize the formula, learn how to use it, and it stops there.
You don't learn anything about real creativity.
Yeah. So now you've got a society, like
Wait, mm-hmm. I just want to say, because I'm in this advanced history class, and you guys probably all know this, but I mean, it's so ridiculous how honest that is, that, in the highest level history class, you...